Bernie Sanders, what are you talking about? Yeah, there's money in politics, and super PACs spend a buttload of it, but that's always how it's been. Or has it? Find out what's going on with campaign finance law on this episode of The End of the Law. Hello and welcome to The End of the Law, the show that looks at what happens when the fringes of humanity meet the ends of the law. I'm Grant Shubin, and every other week I pick out some news story and examine it under existing law to find out how the law deals with modern messes. Today's episode is about campaign finance. You've probably heard of it. You might even be familiar with it. Today, I want to give it some historical and legal background, find out where it comes from, and find out why people like Bernie and even Donald Trump, for that matter, think it's a big deal today. Why wasn't Bob Dole talking about it? Before all that, though, I want to remind you guys, Radio Free Brooklyn is now on Patreon, a website where you can help support us by becoming a patron and donating as little as $1 a month. Radio Free Brooklyn is totally volunteer maintained and operated, and so it takes a lot of work and a little bit of money. If you like this show or any of the other shows on Radio Free Brooklyn, head on over to www.patreon.com/Radio Free Brooklyn to become a patron. Also, please email me. Let me know what you think of the show. Let me know if there's anything out there you're curious about. Let me know what you do want to hear. Let me know what you don't want to hear. The show's email is theendofthelaw@gmail.com. Finally, briefly recapping last week's episode. Last week, my buddy John Ellison came in and we talked about Apple versus the FBI. We covered a lot. Ultimately, what we settled on was that this issue, the idea of whether law enforcement can force private actors to do stuff, is really best suited for Congress. It's not something courts should be deciding. About that show, though, one of you asked whether the FBI needs Apple. That is, why can't the government hack into the phone itself, or why can't the government hire some Silicon Valley genius to break into the phone? Well, the short answer is the FBI doesn't need Apple. The government could try to break into the phone, and they probably could with enough time. It's just more that Apple would be the best at it. It's Apple's software. They know the phone best. They wrote the original security features. And even with that, Apple claims that it would take a team of 8 engineers at least 4 weeks working on this project full-time to develop the software that the FBI wants. So, in short, the FBI doesn't need Apple, it just wants them. And there was actually news about this this week, where apparently some unnamed third party volunteered to break into the iPhone for the government, leaving Apple totally out of it. And what's crazy, though, is I guess that this group did it because Apple has notoriously bad policies regarding security failings of their systems, especially when you compare them to other tech companies. So Google actually offers $100,000 to anyone who can break into their Chromebook, and they're not alone. Lots of companies have these bounties to incentivize hackers out there to work with them and not against them. Apple doesn't. I guess getting past Apple software security hardly gets you a mention on their webpage. So people are talking about this unnamed group helping government as a way for this group to snub their nose at Apple for these crappy policies. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. Today we're talking about campaign finance. But why? Why is there so much talk about campaign finance? Well, it might be that so far this year, there are 2,239 super PACs registered with the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, and they've raised over $600 million and have already spent $260 million. And that's only for 2016. And sure, it's sort of biased of me to say this, but it's a fact, so whatever. Of that $260 million spent so far, $240 million of it has been by conservative PACs, only $15 million by liberal PACs. And this is troubling not only because of the stupid amounts of money going in to get certain politicians elected, but because a lot of this spending is done in secret. But this secret political spending is not a new phenomenon. And actually, throughout American history, Congress has been making new laws to address this or that political money scandal. There's actually a long tradition of the U.S. of knowing where political funding was coming from, of a long history of campaign finance transparency. It all started actually with Teddy Roosevelt, who ran as a trust buster against big corporations. And when he got elected, he signed into law the Tillman Act. And the Tillman Act outlawed corporations from directly contributing to political candidates. And that's still the law today. Corporations cannot directly contribute to political candidates. Goldman Sachs cannot directly contribute to Hillary Clinton. And one of the funny, ironies about Roosevelt signing the Tillman Act into law was that while campaigning, at the same time he was stump speeching all over the country about being against corporate money and politics, he actually was secretly going around to some of the country's biggest corporations and asking for donations. I mean, good for him to keeping his word to voters, but it's kind of a sad foreshadowing that back in 1907, you had to resort to corporate money to get elected. Anyway, the Tillman Act was the status quo for government contributions for some 65 years. And then you get Tricky Dick, Richard Nixon, and the Watergate scandal. And, you know, since some of us weren't born in 1972, the Watergate scandal was basically this. Nixon was running for re-election, and he accepted some $20 million in secret. And in 1972, $20 million was ridiculous. It's like a gajillion dollars. And this secret money was going into a secret fund, and it was basically all given in cash at the time because it was 1972 and Venmo didn't exist. And ultimately, some people were caught breaking into the Democratic National Convention's headquarters in the Watergate Hotel. And when they were caught with some of this $20 million in cash, and way less than $20 million, but they could tell that it was the money that was being donated to Nixon's Political Action Committee, or PAC. So ultimately, this led to a bunch of criminal investigations and indictments and prison sentences and the resignation of Nixon as a president. But what's important for us to keep in mind is that this secret money coming from corporations and big individual donors led a paper trail back to Nixon. And so at its very core, Watergate is a political financing scandal. And in the wake of this whole scandal and with a riled up country, Congress passed a slew of new campaign finance laws. And actually, a lot of people today think that the limits on campaign finance that we put on in the wake of Watergate have led to the bigger problems we have now. So what are those limits? Well, the Federal Election Campaign Act began limiting the amount of money that individuals can contribute to a single campaign. The cap was set at $1,000 for single candidates and a total of $25,000 to federal elections. So I can only give $1,000 to Hillary Clinton, and I can only give a total of $25,000 to all federal candidates. This law also requires the disclosure of all political contributions above $100. So this is why we hear candidates now filing campaign finance reports. Finally, the law set up the Federal Election Commission, or the FEC, to make sure that it was being enforced and to oversee the last thing the law did, which is crazy. The Federal Election Campaign Act set up public financing of presidential elections. Yeah, government-paid presidential elections where candidates use public funds in their primaries and general election campaigns, and the parties use public money in their nominating conventions. This system was still in place until Obama signed legislation putting an end to it on April 3rd, 2014. Practically speaking, though, the program was out long before that. What ended up happening was that the cost of running a presidential campaign far outpaced what the public program was paying to these candidates. So candidates ended up opting out of the public funding option and started raising funds independently. But in this program, candidates would they promised to limit how much they could spend and limit how much they would fundraise. And at some point, just running a presidential campaign in the U.S. became way too high stakes, and television ads became too necessary, and the public program was basically abandoned. Anyway, those were the three things set up by the Federal Election Campaign Act in the wake of Watergate: limits on individual campaign contributions, the creation of the FEC, and the creation of public funding program. And like any law, this law was challenged all the way to the Supreme Court in a case called Buckley versus Valeo. Now, I'll spare you the bummer details, but the take-home is this. The court upheld the law's limits on individual campaign contributions directly to candidates, but it also said that the government cannot limit spending by candidates or their campaigns, and that political contributions to political candidates are versions of free speech, that giving money to a politician is the same as speaking, which ultimately turned out to have huge implications for our political process. Just to cover it again, this means that, one, the government can put limits on individual donations to campaigns. 2, the government cannot limit how much those campaigns spend. And 3, making political donations is the same as speaking. Or depending on how much money you have, making political donations is the same as shouting. And this last one, again, is the really big deal because it means that making political donations is protected by the First Amendment. And there isn't a law out there that Americans love more than the First Amendment. So because it's not easy to limit speech now, neither is it easy to limit political donations. And that's basically one half of the current campaign finance story. The other half deals with these annoying and remarkable things called 501c4 organizations. Now, you've probably heard of 501c3s, which are nonprofits like charities or foundations. And 501c4s are also nonprofits, but they have this added zing of being organizations that operate exclusively for the promotion of social welfare. 501c4s are social welfare organizations. And because they're nonprofits, they don't have to pay any federal income tax. And also being nonprofits, they largely exist by fundraising or donations. But an added wrinkle into this situation is that they don't have to say who their donors are. They can keep them totally anonymous. And this wasn't really that big deal for a long stretch after 501c4s were created in 1913. I mean, they were mostly dedicated to animal welfare or helping end poverty or whatever social good you want. But increasingly, they became more and more political. So in the early 1960s, the IRS realized that 501c4s and politics were intertwined and that there was nothing they can do about it. So they started loosening rules to allow 501c4s to engage more directly in the political process. And then just trying to keep things in check, they released a rule that said that 501c4s were legally allowed to be engaged in politics as long as 51% of their funds were spent on social welfare, meaning that 49% of their funds could be spent politically. And they actually had to back into this rule a little bit because originally they had said that 501c4's funds had to be spent, quote, primarily on social welfare, but nobody could figure out what primarily meant. So they came up with this 51-49 split. And this was basically the way things went from 1981 on. You had these 501c4s that as soon as they spent more than $2,600 on a campaign were called political action committees or PACs. And they would be independent of the candidate, but they would spend money to get a candidate elected. And initially, these PACs spent money in a way totally different to how we think of now. Back in the day, it was more like tasteful. And that is until the 1988 election when George H.W. Bush was running against Michael Dukakis and the first modern political attack ad was run. The National Security Political Action Committee, the NSPAC, which was pro-Bush but officially unaffiliated with the campaign like all PACs, ran the following ad.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
So, duh, this ad links Dukakis with these weekend passes, and it does so in a time where politicians had to be tough on crime. But the fact of the matter is Dukakis actually inherited the program from his Republican predecessor, but he was in favor of it, and in favor of course, until he started running for president. And in any event, this ad was highly criticized. People said that it was inaccurate. They said that it stoked racial tensions, but it was effective. In fact, people said that this ad was the reason that Dukakis lost the general election. But what's remarkable about the ad is that the Bush campaign was essentially out of the controversy. Sure, they benefited from it, but it was the NSPAC that ran the ad, which was independent of the Bush campaign. And there you have it. That's how modern political attack ads were born. And not only were they born, but they were born into this particular history or this particular historical context. They were born into a situation where individual campaign contributions were limited. But they're also born into a time where these things called 501c4s that you could donate to anonymously that would do your political spending and speaking for you. And then 2010 rolls around and you get the meatball case, the grand enchilada, the case that is the backbone of what you hear Bernie talking about, Citizens United versus the FEC. So Citizens United was a PAC that was spending money on advertisements on a movie that was essentially one long Hillary Clinton attack ad in her 2008 presidential campaign. And these ads were actually being run 30 days within the general election, or I think a primary, that was illegal. And when the FEC tried to take Citizens United to task for running these ads illegally, Citizens United stepped their game up and they actually sued back the FEC, saying that because political spending is speech, that they could speak whenever they want and that this 30-day rule was bogus. And one hugely important detail, though, about the rule that political spending is speech is that that rule only applied to individual human beings, not to corporations or 501c4s. And you can guess where this is going. The Supreme Court held that the right to free speech extends to corporations as individual persons. This means that corporations can spend politically as a form of free speech, meaning that huge, huge sums of money can now be injected into our political processes on a scale and secrecy that we've never seen before. So, to be as clear as possible, Citizens United said that corporations, as individual legal persons, which they are, have the same right to speak and therefore the same right to donate politically as individual human beings. Citizens United, however, did not overturn Buckley, meaning that individual spending limits directly to campaigns are still valid. So you can see here why super PACs become so important. They're like little vessels that collect and spend corporate money, not actually on a campaign, but on ads and whatever else happens parallel to a campaign. This is what freaks Sanders out. And corporations' ability to fund super PACs is what the uproar in the wake of Citizens United is all about. But Citizens United wasn't without its limitations. Or, I mean, it kind of wasn't without its limitations. In the case, the Supreme Court said that super PACs couldn't directly donate to political campaigns and that to the extent that they run ads for a candidate, they could not coordinate with that candidate. But what, quote, coordinating means is not very well defined, and it's kind of a joke to think that it's not going on. Now, of course, it's impossible to find out whether or not there are any backroom conversations that happen between a PAC and a campaign, but one amazing thing that definitely does happen is that candidates film hours and hours of raw footage and then upload it to YouTube for super PACs to use in running their ads. And if you haven't seen the supercut of Ted Cruz's 13-hour film, you are in for a treat. CNN actually did the best version of it. But again, what happens here is that super PACs cannot coordinate with candidates and candidates cannot coordinate with super PACs, but candidates want the super PAC money, so candidates film hours and hours and hours of just random footage of them, you know, holding their husband or wife's hand or, you know, hugging their mom or praying with their children, and then just upload it raw to YouTube, and then the PACs go take that footage, incorporate it into their ads. But in the case of Ted Cruz in particular, they were too lazy to edit out, you know, some of the outtakes. And so what you get is a pretty hysterical amalgamation of Ted Cruz family awkwardness. But anyway, I know I already mentioned it, but just for the record, both parties have and use super PACs, but Republicans hugely outspend the Democrats. Again, so far this campaign season, Republicans have spent $244 million and Democrats have spent 15. 244 to 15. And the fact of the matter is most of these ads take a nod from NS PACs taking down Dukakis, meaning that now they're negative ads. And sure, this is kind of doom and gloom, but we set ourselves up for this. The good intentions of the Federal Election Campaign Act were corrupted by the failure of federal funding to keep pace with the cost of campaigns. It was corrupted by Buckley and the Supreme Court's rule that giving political money is the same as making a political statement. And it was corrupted by our mutant-like appetite for inflammatory and negative campaign ads. Put another way, because the Federal Elections Campaign Act put limits on spending, but people wanted to spend more, they found a way. And that way wasn't very difficult to find in the wake of Buckley and the notion that giving money is a form of speech, and the type of way that you speak wasn't very difficult in the wake of NS PAC's Weekend Pass ad and the takedown of Dukakis. But is this a bad thing? Has Citizens United really done that much to change our democracy? It kind of depends on where you look. And before we get into it, here's Van Morrison, If in Money You Trust.
If in money we trust. Give them money with trust, and you bite the dust, and it's not enough. Give them money you trust, but it's not enough, and you bite the dust. death and money you trust.
So where are we left? Well, for starters, where we are now is on the back of literally more than 100 years of campaign finance law, starting with Teddy Roosevelt and the passing of the Tillman Act and its outlawing of corporate donations directly to political candidates. And then, of course, there's the Watergate scandal and the subsequent Federal Elections Campaign Act, which limited individual contributions to candidates. Those limits, though, created a huge gap, a huge need for some different way to raise money, especially considering the increasing cost of running a campaign. Kind of dampening this movement for limits, though, was the Supreme Court's holding in Buckley versus Valeo that giving money to candidates is the same as speaking, is protected by the First Amendment. Then, of course, we have 501c4s or PACs, which are set up in a way to deal with the Federal Election Campaign Act's limiting of individual donations to candidates and allow people to donate in these weird offshoot organizations that don't work with the candidate but try to get the candidate elected. And the donation door for 501c4s was blown wide open with 2010 Citizens United versus the FEC, where the Supreme Court decided that corporations have the right to speak with donations just as much as individual people, meaning that Exxon or Goldman Sachs or Lockheed Martin can give unlimited amounts of money to super PACs and 501c4s to get their favorite political candidate elected. But does that matter? Look at the success records of candidates that have had blinding super PAC money. Mitt Romney. Lost. Jeb Bush. Lost. Hillary Clinton has won. She's sure she's winning, but people still hate her. And actually, Bernie and Trump used disavowing super PACs as a political win. So in one sense, super PACs don't seem to be all that effective. But these are in presidential races. Where super PACs are doing their most damage is in state and local contests, especially during non-presidential election years. The fact of the matter is that 82% of winners in the Senate and 94% of winners in the House are the people who raise the most money. And we all know from President Obama's presidency, and it's super clear now in Judge Garland and his filling of Scalia's empty Supreme Court seat, is that an obstinate Congress can go a very, very long way in obstructing a particular person or a particular party's success. And ultimately, money in politics is, go figure, politicizing us more. Take taxing the rich, for instance. Most Democrats are for it, lots of independents are for it, and even a large minority of Republicans are for it. In fact, enough of them are for it that you would expect certain Republican representatives to give way on the issue a little bit. Except for not taxing the rich is a major part of conservative fundraising. And same on the Democrat side for abortion. People on all sides of the aisle agree that abortion should be available, but being strongly pro-choice is a big money-making issue for politicians in terms of their super PACs, so they come out harder than maybe their constituencies are. In other words, we get along much better than the money in politics makes us seem, but money muffles that common ground in the interests of getting in power. So as the rhetoric rises and it gets more zero-sum, so do our positions, ultimately pushing us farther and farther from each other, and it's doing so at the congressional level that's becoming more and more an immovable object. Like I mentioned earlier, Radio Free Brooklyn is now on Patreon, which is a way for listeners like you to support us and keep this station going. go to www.patreon.com/Radio Free Brooklyn to sign up to be a patron for as little as $1 a month. Also, send me emails. There's actually one show left. Well, there's two, but there's kind of one. It's because the last show I'm going to be doing is going to recap all the shows I've done before. You might be asking yourself what John Kerry's acknowledgement of ISIS genocide has done to help victims of genocide. Or what does it do to change the U.S.'s policy towards ISIS? Or what did Obama's executive action on gun control accomplish? Or what about refugees? Is that still an issue? But anyway, there's only one show left. And to be frank, I have no idea what I'm going to cover. I fed you guys all sorts of weird ideas about what I'm going to cover, and there's been a few hoorays and a couple harumphs there, and I don't really know what you guys want to hear most, so please let me know at theendofthelaw@gmail.com. I'm Grant Shubin. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. This is The End of the Law, and this is the end of the show.